The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This episode is sponsored by Smarkets. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder and director of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie LeConte.
Our guest today is journalist, author and broadcaster Alistair Campbell. Hello, Alistair.
Hello.
Alistair has worked as a bagpipe busker, a roulette dealer, but is admittedly most famous as a political journalist for the Daily Mirror and Prime Minister Tony Blair's press secretary and director of communications. He's now editor-at-large of The New European and chief interviewer for GQ magazine. He's also written a number of best-selling books, including seven volumes of his diaries, the latest of which is From Crash to Defeat, covering the period from 2007 to 2010. He also went to the same school as Gary Lineker and Emil Heskey. We may discuss that later. But inevitably, we must immediately turn to the key question of today. Alistair, in 2011, you were the quizmaster at a quiz arranged by Portland Communication. Mm-hmm. And in your role as quizmaster, you oversaw a team of between 12 and 15 people from the BBC fail on their first tiebreaker question. So you arranged for a second tiebreaker, which they won, beating a team from YouGov, which at only five people had not exceeded the maximum number allowed. Given everything that's happened since, how do you now feel about your decision?
What was my decision?
Your decision was to allow victory for the BBC team, despite the fact they'd failed at the first tiebreaker and not won.
And what were the questions?
I think the questions I thought you were going to say
that in 2011, I warned that if we were ever to have a referendum on Britain's position in place in the European Union, and if that were to be lost, that it would be a catastrophe for the country.
Well, and
that would have been a visionary statement.
We could come on to discuss that, but I think the key question...
Was I wearing a kilt?
I think the important thing is that the YouGov team, and in the interest of full disclosure, of which I was captain, we had not exceeded the maximum number of permissible contestants.
We had won
the first tiebreaker that you had set, and then you decided that a second tiebreaker was in order, and the BBC team, which, and I will stress again, had between 12 to 15 people.
Joe, did you just get Alistair on the podcast to discuss this? Are we actually just not going to talk about Brexit?
Has it been the long game? If you're saying, I can only think, I have no memory of this at all.
Oh, what?
Okay, it may be...
All I can say is, Alistair, some people remember clearly.
Hopefully, I may have covered it in yet-to-be-published Volume 8 or 9.
Defeat for YouGov, which will be the title.
From Crash to YouGov.
YouGov were robbed.
However, I can only imagine I was trying to be nice to the BBC in the hope that if we ever got to a referendum, they wouldn't be sort of slavishly pro-Brexit, as you know, some of them clearly are.
And that was an impressive segue.
And it didn't work. So let's give it to YouGov. But, you know, YouGov's not really. I mean, I'm not much keener on YouGov than I am the BBC.
I think we can all be frank. They're not what they once were. No. But there is other news, obviously. And we meet just hours after the announcement that the 48 letters have been received. Well, at least 48. Graham Brady would not be drawn on how many he's actually received, just that the number has been exceeded, the 15% threshold. So what's going to happen next?
I don't know. I don't think any of us know. I mean, I think that I hate to say this because I'm actually a very, very patriotic Brit. And one of the things I most hated about the referendum campaign was this idea that somehow the Leave side were patriotic. But I actually feel quite ashamed to be British at the moment. I think we are projecting to the world a sense of incompetence, division, disorder, sort of just out of touch with the modern world. And I've worked for prime ministers, and I think the authority and the voice of the prime minister is a very, very important part of the national armoury. And what we saw today was somebody who is just... I mean, I used to think she was driven by duty. I think she's utterly delusional now. And it's sort of tragic to watch, but it's the country that's getting really badly damaged. And I don't know where it ends. I mean, look, I'm, as you know, working with the People's Vote campaign. I think this has got to go back to the people at some point. How we get there, I don't know. But I feel ashamed. I feel sort of uncomfortable just with everything that's going on.
We'll come on to discuss the people's vote in a bit, but from a timing point of view, we know that the Conservatives can't really control the timing because they don't know how many letters have been received. At least officially, they don't know how many letters have been received. Do you think this was a good time, or perhaps one of the better times to be holding this no confidence vote?
No, not really. Obviously, if you're engaged in any campaign, momentum is incredibly important, and I'm imagining, if they really are trying to get rid of her, I'm imagining that they're trying to create that sense of inevitability that's going to happen. But what are you seeing? I saw a tweet from Jim Murphy. Are you allowed to say the F word on this programme?
If you're Marie, yeah.
Okay. Jim Murphy did a tweet that he was at a bus stop and he overheard these three guys having this terrible row, and one of them called the other one an FC. And he turned around and there were three Tory MPs arguing about Brexit. And I remember when Alan Clark...
It sounds like the beginning of a great joke. There's three Tory MPs arguing.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a great joke, but it did kind of underline just what a mess they're in. And what you're seeing, I think you're seeing this actually right across Parliament. I mean, Ken Clark said the other day that, you know, this Parliament now is just a bunch of competing factions. You're seeing it in Labour as well, that the parties are not really... So something is kind of giving in our political system. You know, I just wonder that we are in one of those periods of such turbulence and such turmoil that just things are going to break apart. I don't know, but it feels that to me that she is totally the wrong sort of person to be in that job at the moment, because she seems to be incapable of actually empathising, of building alliances. And do you know one of the problems? I've written about this in the New European this week, and this was before today. But I wrote about the fact that in leadership, in politics, in any leadership position, really, you need to be able to build alliances, you need to be able to reach out to people, you need to be able to kind of just develop different sorts of relationships. And it seems to me she can't do that, so she has no reputational friendship capital in the bank, either with her MPs or with the European leaders. I talk to some of these European leaders, they say that when she goes to these meetings, she's completely the same as you see on the television. She just talks to them the same way she talks to the public.
Because the argument is always, oh, well, one-on-one, she's always very good. But people never say that about people who are good communicators.
But also, I feel like people don't even really say that about Theresa May. Because I remember a friend of mine had to meet her at some reception, and he got stuck talking to her, which is apparently like completely mortifying. And the only thing he was like, eventually, I was like, ha-ha. And I went, so, you know, Prime Minister, how's Maidenhead? Then she lit up, and we were able to kind of get through the next 4 minutes of conversation without it being mortifying.
One of her colleagues in the coalition told me that she's the only person he'd ever met who, if you're having a conversation with her, she can say something and then you say something, and if she thinks she's dealt with the point you raised in what she said first time round, she doesn't feel the need to say anything. She literally can just sit there in silence, and he says that then you sort of just burble and blurt and talk complete nonsense. But I think the Salzburg summit, which is one of the many missteps on the way to the absolute mess we're in now, she turned up, she had a few minutes to sort of make her case, and she read an article. She basically read out an article she'd written in a German newspaper, which they'd all been briefed on anyway. I keep hearing people saying, oh, I feel a bit sorry for her. I mean, you might, you know, yes, she's under pressure. Yes, she's got massive responsibilities and a big workload. But you just get the feeling she can't do what you need to do to lead a country.
But I think, in terms of the Conservative Party, though, isn't there the issue that no one else could really do that job at the moment? Because, you know, even in 2016 when she won, she partly won because people are like, you know, she's kind of the unifying candidate because no one loves her, but a lot of people kind of tolerate her and like her.
Yeah.
But currently, like, there are so many factions who hate each other so much.
Yeah.
And there's such a lack of trust, I think, which is even more important than whether they like each other or not.
Yeah.
That who could possibly kind of, again, make enough alliances to just about kind of...
Maybe. I mean, that's a fair point. And you do wonder whether there isn't going to be a right-wing, massively anti-European, clean break, let's be honest, that we want a kind of Singapore on the Thames, and that's what we really believe Brexit should be about, and that they go off and form their own party. Now, of course, the reason they don't want to do that is they know they wouldn't win. And this whole Brexit thing for me, this is why I get so frustrated that Labour Party's not been more kind of on it in terms of opposing it. I think the hard Brexit, it's a really right-wing project. And they're basically using the referendum, this is my view, they're using the referendum to try to create an economic and social model for which they would never, ever get a parliamentary majority in this country.
But the problem is that there's no parliamentary majority for that kind of Brexit at the moment, though, is there?
No, there's no parliamentary majority for anything at the moment. My point is that whether that right wing shouldn't kind of be honest and just sort of drift off and argue for what it really believes, as opposed to pretending that Brexit's easy. That's why we're in this mess, because Brexit was going to be easy, the trade deals were going to fall out of the sky, we're going to get more money for the health service, there'd be no hit on the economy, all the lies that were told. And now we're seeing that actually there's no Brexit that can be done without pain.
And similarly, there's no Brexit that is popular with a majority of the public either. The two most popular options are hard Brexit and remain in the EU,
yeah,
when you give the full range of things, none of which are particularly popular. So the question is, if you were a Tory MP going into the meeting tonight, would you vote for Theresa May or would you vote to bring her down?
If I was a Tory MP who wants a people's vote, I don't know, it's hard to work out. I think, look, from the people's vote perspective, I feel that's where it's heading. There's a part of me says that if she's locked in the job for another 12 months, which she will be if she survives, then is that good for us or is that bad for us? I find it very hard to work out because it all depends on who would follow and what would happen in that. So, for example, let's just say that Boris Johnson becomes the leader of the Conservative Party. You've got on record already quite a lot of Tory MPs saying that they would leave the party. You're talking about a split. Now, whether they would or not, I don't know. If one of the kind of Hunt, Javid sort of, you know, that kind of, I mean, by the way, they both have to work on their voices. A little bit of advice there. But if you had that sort of person coming through, where does... I don't know. I honestly, I'm completely at a loss to work it out. I think...
And do you think this therefore is going to be a real problem for the MPs themselves?
But I think surely the odds are too high. I think if you're
it's
a Tory MP from any faction, the chances of someone from your faction, or like a friendly one, going into power, I think, is just like so unpredictable that surely you just stay for the status quo, like you just vote for the status quo. I think there's a level of risk, which is weird as well, because it's not historically in the Conservatives' DNA to kind of go for the mad risk, but clearly they keep doing it.
They're quite fratricidal, aren't they? They're much more fratricidal than we are.
No, but even from a, like, I think, selfish point of view, I don't think any given faction can be absolutely certain that their candidate will even make it to the last two at the stage.
I caught the end of Newsnight last night. Damian McGrean was on as the sort of, you know, the Theresa May loyalist, even though he voted against the last week. And he struck me as being really angry beneath a calm exterior. And I do think there is an awful lot of anger at these ERG types.
So you think that'll manifest itself in people supporting May?
I think she'll win because I think people are scared of what might come.
How many does she need to win by? I mean, clearly if she wins by one, she's in real trouble.
I'm absolutely convinced if she wins by one, she'll say, right, I'm onwards and upwards. And
I fight to win.
Yeah. I mean, I was watching with my daughter and she comes out. It is extraordinary. I mean, there's something almost... Did you see the Andy Serkis Gollum?
Yes,
no,
of course.
Brutal.
If you haven't seen that, that's the latest of the video memes flying around social media.
It's gone big.
Yes.
It's gone big,
even bigger than the Unilad people cross-dressing.
Yeah, it's gone very, very big.
The previous leader.
But he's onto something, because it showed this absolute... Conviction doesn't even sort of get it. It's like a... What are you showing us now?
Breaking news. Breaking. Former Brexit secretaries Dominic Raab and David Davis have teamed up with DUP leader Arlene Foster to launch a campaign for a better deal for Brexit.
So that's a
fun alliance.
Sorry. Oh, please. What does that mean? You see, this is if we do get to a people's vote, there's obviously all this discussion now about what should the question be and da-da-da. And you said that the two options that seem to have sort of support, one is a hard Brexit, harder Brexit than hers, and the other is remaining in the European Union. Now, on the Remain side, it cannot just be the status quo and it cannot just be a sort of rerun of the last campaign. It's got to be about shaping a different sort of Europe and how a kind of, you know, Britain that stays could do that. But on the Brexit side, the reason we're in this mess is because you had all these different people in the Leave campaign who were able to sort of persuade the public to put whatever version of Brexit they wanted onto the kind of psychological side of a bus. Part of our job, and part of the job of politics in trying to get a more honest referendum, if we do get another one, is actually to force the Leave side to have a credible, coherent plan.
I mean, in effect, they were following the playbook that Alex Salmond deployed so usefully during the Scottish referendum campaign, which was whatever you want to change will change, whatever you want to remain the same will remain the same, and that will be true at an individual level.
Yeah.
And tying people down to that, I imagine, is going to be difficult. But from the point of view of the Conservative leaders, you need, whoever that may be, you need a person and you need a plan.
Yeah.
And at the moment, there doesn't appear to be a plan forthcoming, though indeed we may see that develop over the next hours, if not days. But crucially, when it comes to the person, the polling on this is pretty clear in that the candidates divide into two groups, those the public generally don't know and those the public generally don't like. And yeah. That is not a great position to be in. Boris Johnson has the highest figures for people who think he would make a good PM, but it's still under 25%, and you have more than half who think he'd make a bad PM. Sajid Javid comes out top on balance, but that's only because he has so large numbers of people saying don't know. I don't think that strikes me as a particularly good situation to be in if you're about to hold a leadership election.
Who's the John Major figure?
I would say it was Sajid Javid.
But he's so... I don't think
he's really
it.
Boring.
Well, as opposed to John Major, who was amazing. As he stood
life
there,
in sort of
dripping
the party.
Charisma.
Yeah, but it's funny, isn't it, how he's... No, that's a fair point, I guess.
I mean, although, we think no, of listen, John Major no, now as the great the great statesman.
No, I was a journalist covering John Major. I knew him very well.
Was he a good one-on-one?
He was, actually. Yeah. No, he was. But and then, of course, when I started working for Tony Blair, I felt it was part of my job to try to destroy him. But I do think he's emerged as a really serious, credible figure within this whole Brexit debate, for sure. I really do. And I don't say that just because he says, you know, what I like to hear. I actually think he has made really significant interventions, and they've been important and well made. And back then, even though he was a surprise, I didn't think, if I wrote a piece in the Sunday Mirror magazine, I'll tell you, when he was chief secretary, saying, I reckon this guy could go the whole way. So he definitely had something. I mean, I listened to Sajid Javid on the telly the other day, and he's got a weak face and he's got a weak voice. And I know that it's not all about that. It's what about what you believe. But what comes through to me is quite a weak personality.
He does look, I think, and I genuinely mean that as a serious problem, but his face always looks like someone who's smiling, but they've been kidnapped and they have to like pretend that everything is fine. So his mouth is smiling and his eyes are screaming help. But genuinely, if you look at his pictures, it's always the case. His eyes look weirdly sad and panicked and he still has a smile.
And of course, it's worth pointing out for both our listeners that the process this goes through is that the...
What are their names?
One is called Jill. And Jill. That's my mum. The process that we go through is that the Conservatives select the two candidates, the Conservative MPs, yeah, select the two candidates that then go forward to the membership.
So that
and
suggests
that's when
it
really
will be a hard Brexit leader, does it not?
Unless a hard Brexit person doesn't make it through to the final two. If
Do you think the appetite amongst the MPs is actually for Johnson not to be on the ballot?
My reading of the tea leaves is that that is the appetite at the moment, but there's no guarantee that that would change.
Mm. No, I agree, and I think the Boris thing is quite interesting because it
Johnson,
keeps coming in waves.
John.
Oh, sorry, yes.
Oh, we've had this. It's like having Bob Hutton back.
You didn't say Sajid, did you?
I think I might have.
You said
it's quite like first
Javid.
Names. You're fine. Well, the thing with Johnson, which is quite interesting, I think, is that it keeps coming in waves. Where I think
Johnson, the liar and charlatan. You have to use.
Well, that's a bit long. Well, that's a bit long.
We're entirely politically neutral here.
Are
Alistair? Yeah, we hate everyone.
But you can't say he's not a liar and a charlatan. Well, it must be universally.
Some say.
You might well think that.
What does your polling say on that?
Some say, including a proportion of the public, that he's not trustworthy.
Yeah.
The thing is, yeah, I think it does come in waves of Tory MPs occasionally going, oh, hang on, you know, how about him? You know, how about him as leader? And then that kind of crashes and then comes back. Because I remember, when was it? I think around July, just before summer recess, there were kind of rumours that Tory MPs were starting again to kind of like coalesce around Johnson. And then clearly like, that went nowhere. So I'm
Johnson,
not sure.
The Lion Charlton.
Again, that was just a bit long.
Full name.
You've written a book on winners, Alistair.
Number one bestseller.
Number one.
I'm getting offers to make it into TV series, but yeah. I don't have time.
Presumably, these are people that won on the first tiebreak question and then go through to the second one. But anyway, we'll pass over that for just a second. From what you know, then about winners from that book, you look at the current candidates, not thinking about who can win the leadership. Who do you think stands the best chance of winning a general election?
Alan Mack.
I mean, the theme of the book, I'm glad you're allowing me to plug two books, not just one.
Oh, well,
Christmas.
We're very happy.
Christmas, isn't
exactly.
It?
Presumably they're available for more good.
And presumably, would you have much crossover with Matt Ford's listenership?
Probably.
You know, he does these political chat shows and stuff.
I've vaguely heard of
Comedian,
him.
Very funny.
Not very funny.
Name
no.
rings a vague bell.
Funny.
He's like half
fronted
as funny
the
as me.
Fronted the People's Vote rally on the weekend, did
yeah,
it very
yeah.
well.
That's right, yeah. I think he's about 30% as funny as me
okay.
on last measures.
Well, I'm doing his last show before Christmas at some place in Leicester Square, and it's just literally just before Christmas, and I will have a large selection of my books for sale as last-minute Christmas
presents. So what you're saying is if someone were listening to this...
Who is not listening to Matt Ford, but is in the vicinity of Leicester Square. Can't remember the date, but it's the last week before Christmas, and I'll be there.
So just hang around for the entire last week before Christmas, hang around the West End looking
for Alistair
Campbell.
I never buy a Christmas present until the 23rd, usually. One of the big themes of that book, and this is not hindsight, because I said, and it was written before the referendum, and I said that David Cameron's big mistake, in my view, or his big weakness, is that he confuses strategy and tactics. And I think we're now playing that out, because the referendum was a tactic, because he never really had a strategy for Britain and Europe. And he didn't really have a strategy for winning the election beyond what we know, which is... and fair play to him, he hasn't deleted the tweet that says... stability with me or chaos with Ed Miliband. My question would be, looking at all these people, these Tory contenders, do I see any of them who have what I might consider to be a strategic vision as to what Britain should be, and then the ability to make that happen? And I don't, to be frank. I think Johnson really is a busted flush. And also, I think the thing that, you know, I speak as somebody who was a journalist and who does a bit of journalism now, but I don't see myself as sort of driven by journalism. But I do think with Boris Johnson and Michael Gove that they never really stop being journalists. For them, it's always about the next line, the next story, the next narrative about themselves. It's not really about a sense of having a vision for why they want power. And I found that with... I'm a bit, you know, anti-Oldertonian, but I do think this sense that the sort of rich posh boys, that they kind of did a bit of business, they did a bit of other jobs, and they thought, you know, it'd be really good fun to run the Tory party, and then it'd be really good fun to run the country. And I think that's sort of the mess that we're in.
But then the flip side of that then is...
So none of them, I'm afraid.
And so does that mean, given that one assumes someone has to win the general election, does that mean that Labour are now in the driving seat?
Well, I mean, I think it's extraordinary that given the mess that the government's in, given the state of the country, given the state of our public services, given the state of the fact you can't walk to work without having to, you know, walk past about 100 people sleeping on the street, given that the trains don't work, given that the police are getting shredded, and the Brexit mess on top, it's amazing that Labour are still struggling in the polls relative to the Conservatives.
Yeah, I mean,
I suspect what's going to happen now at the next election is, I think the country, you know, I never thought we'd get used to minority and coalition governments, but I suspect the country's not going to give a majority to anybody.
The polls certainly suggest at the moment that it's maybe Labour ahead, maybe the Conservatives ahead, depending on who you look to the polls. But certainly no one is anything near the kind of numbers that you need to get that majority.
And also, I mean, I know you guys are into data and stuff. I can remember back in 97 being in a hotel in Luton, getting a phone call from the Daily Telegraph. This was during the campaign, asking me to comment on a poll that they'd just done. I think it was Gallup.
Yeah, it would have been Gallup back then.
And it was, I think we were 31 points ahead. And there's me, as the Labour guy, saying, that is a rogue poll. That is utter nonsense. Because I was by now terrified that people, a bit like the referendum, they weren't going to bother to vote.
Yeah, because of course they've been wrong in 92. Because they thought it was a foregone conclusion. Yeah. And we'll come back to voting patterns later. From what you were saying about David Cameron, you're David Cameron back just after the result of the referendum has been announced. If he hadn't resigned, do you think we would be in a better or worse position than we are now?
It's very hard to kind of argue a counter.
Surely there would have been.
I think there would have been a vote.
I think he would have been toppled. Theresa May, for quite a lot of Conservative MPs, is not Brexity enough. Even, you know, despite the Lancaster House speech, etc. Cameron was never going to stay. I think there would have been a no confidence vote. He would have been out in about 6 months.
He might have ended up in the same place. I suspect he would have handled the negotiations better than this. And I think Theresa May's, she's made a whole load of mistakes, but the first big one, I think, was to overreact to the fact that people on the Brexit side were saying she's a Remainer, because it made her go very much down the kind of ERG, Rees-Mogg route. You know, the Lancaster House speech with the red lines, out the single market, out the customs union, out the European Court of Justice, I think that came as a big shock to quite a lot of the Brexiteers. She went way too far, and of course now she's ended up not being able to satisfy them, en route pissing off, you know, a lot of people on, as it were, my side of the argument, and now she's ended up pissing off the other side as well.
We had David Gawk on the Today programme this morning, and then Theresa May herself backing it up in the statement, saying that a leadership contest would inevitably mean that Brexit was delayed and that there had to be, it would have to be an extension to Article 50. Do we know if that's actually true, or is that just them? Is that just them positioning?
Well, I hope it's true. We're in such a mess, I think Article 50 is going to have to be extended anyway.
Prior to the announcement, Jenny Chapman, a Labour frontbencher, told LBC that Labour will call a vote of no confidence and it's likely to be before Christmas. Will this will this make them less likely or more likely to call the vote of confidence?
Well, interestingly, I heard her because I was next up on LBC. And I welcomed what seemed to me like a step in the right direction. Then by the time I was finished my interview, there seemed to be a bit of backtracking going on.
Remarkable.
Labour's position is confusing.
We're going to come back to Brexit in just a second, but there has been some other news around. Picking up from our edition last week where we discussed the Gilets Jaunes.
How did you pronounce that?
That was
Jesus
bad.
Christ.
Gilets Jaunes. Egypt has taken the step to ban the yellow vests by banning the sale of yellow vests. Sellers have been instructed not to sell fluorescent safety vests unless it's in bulk wholesale to verified companies. This seems in Egypt. They're so worried.
Robert, I wonder if they're selling them to France because they realize there's a very big market for them there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Any exporter would be doing a good job on that.
How are school trips going to work now?
In Egypt.
Yeah, with all the tiny like yellow vests for the kids.
I don't know. My school didn't get to do trips to Egypt. And Wayne Rooney has attended a reception at the White House. Donald Trump's son, Barron, is reported to be a huge fan of DC United, Wayne Rooney's team, although Wayne Rooney has not publicly ruled out being interviewed for the position of Donald Trump's new chief of staff.
Weirder things have happened this year. Like, honestly, there
weirder things have happened today.
There would be, yeah, there would be a six-hour story, and then we'd move on and be like, fine. Yeah.
I think Piers will beat him to it.
if that's your choice for new
Piers
chief
Morgan
of staff between
Wayne
Piers
Rooney.
Morgan and Wayne Rooney, yeah. It's quite a combo.
Oh, dear. Yes. We takes back control, money, borders, laws, blue passports.
We're joined now for our weekly chat with Sarbjit from Smarkets. Hello, Sarbjit.
Hi there. How are you doing?
We are doing well, and I'm doing even better after winning my bet on the fact that there would be no TV debate. So I'm very happy with that. But we're recording this in advance of the no confidence vote tonight in Theresa May. How do the markets look on that?
Well, we've got markets about the total votes against May. At the moment, we're looking at between 100 and 149, trading at 42%. We do have...
Wow.
Yeah, and we ultimately do have a winning this vote of no confidence at 82% at the moment.
Okay, because I think, yeah, like, as we speak, and obviously that's going to change hour by hour, but I think currently 123 Conservative MPs have said that they will back May. But obviously it is an anonymous ballot, so they can still say one thing and then do another, so who knows?
Yeah, the market is changing all the time. Literally, as I'm speaking to you now, the prices are changing. Yeah, this is a really hot topic and people are really getting involved.
And what kind of price can you get on fewer than 48 votes?
Fewer than 48. So let's say under 50 votes, we have got 5% on that. So if you were to put in £1, you would get back £21.01.
Well, if that indeed happened, we shall see. And how's this affected the timing of the next election market?
So we're looking at the next UK general election market. 2018 is at less than 0.5%. 2019,
well, given that constitutionally it can't happen in 2018, that would be a real surprise and a Christmas treat for us.
Yes, it would probably have to take place on Christmas Day. 2019 is obviously there, 42% at the moment. The next available one would be 2022 at 32%. So we're looking at 2019 that has the confidence of the market.
This week we've been discussing the possibility of a second referendum with our guest Alistair Campbell. Obviously all of the events this week have a huge impact on many things. Have they had an impact on the market for that?
Yes, we've got a number of referendum markets on Smarkets. We have one on whether we'll have another in-out referendum. That's just a straight two choice. That has had, you know, yes, always trading below no for a long time. But recently, the price has narrowed on that quite a lot. We've now got there being another in-out referendum before 2020 at 45%, which is as close as it's ever been. Looking across at the three option people's vote on the Brexit deal, that's quite stark, saying actually the price of no is around 83% on that market. So it looks like it's going to be a two option deal if it's going to be any deal.
And inevitably, of course, there's the discussion about who will be the next Tory leader. Boris Johnson was ahead when we previously discussed. How has that changed now?
The next Conservative leader is, well, Boris Johnson's back on top again. And he's shot up recently. In the last couple of days, he's gone up to 18%. Well ahead of his next rival, Sajid Javid, who's trading at around 14%. When these things seem to come to a head, Johnson always jumps up in prices, regardless of how well the others are doing.
With all this turmoil, is there a question about who will be the next cabinet minister to leave?
Well, yeah, unsurprisingly, Theresa May has shot up in the chance to be the next Theresa cabinet member to leave. I can't understand why that is. She's trading currently at 61%. Well above Penny Mordaunt, who's the next challenger at 20%.
Sajid, thank you once again, and thank you to Smarkets, and we will see you next week for the Christmas special.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
Just before we go back to the discussion, we've got a Polling Politics live event to announce. This is very exciting. It's the big political quiz of the year, and it'll be taking place on Wednesday, the 19th of December, which, you're right, is my dad's birthday. He won't be coming, but I will be there. It'll be at the Seckford Pub in Clerkenwell. It'll be packed with all your favourite obscure political facts and things that have happened in 2018. Marie, can you think of anything interesting that's happened in 2018?
And not really, to be honest.
No, it'd probably be short of content. But we're offering great prizes. Spaces are limited, so have a look at our Twitter or Facebook for details of reserving your team. Hope to see you all there. But obviously we can't have Alistair Campbell in Delta Poll Towers without discussing Brexit more generally and specifically the people's vote. Alistair, some people have said that even calling it the people's vote is not fair, and that a second referendum or a third referendum, depending on when you count, is more reasonable. What pathway do you see the process taking to allow that to happen?
First of all, on your point about the naming, you know, I keep being asked, mainly on the media or on the public, you know, was the first referendum a people's vote? Well, yes, it was. The point is, if you like, the differentiation between people having a say and politicians who are making a complete, absolute pig's ear of it. You know, I've been involved in a lot of campaigns in my time, but this one, given it only started in March, it's gone from sort of, you know, zero recognition and awareness, where virtually every interview I did at the time that we were starting was, what's the point, this is impossible, to now actually I think being probable, not definite, but I think it's tipped over the 50% line. The routes they're varied. I still, even though this morning's performance made me a little less even less confident about this, it's not impossible she ends up doing it, Theresa May.
As a sort of last resort?
Absolutely. I've tried my best. I've really tried to get the country to understand that my deal, I think, is the only deal. And I think she could become almost like a referee of what you were talking about, a kind of harder Brexit against Remain. And she sort of just owns that process and gets on with trying to run the country meanwhile. I think Labour eventually will get to this.
When you say eventually, I mean, there's not much time remaining. What timescale do you think will lead to Labour coming round?
Well, when you say there's not much time remaining, there's not much time remaining to January the 21st, and there's not much time remaining to the end of March. But there is, within the process, the possibility of extending Article 50 and extending the process. So that can be done. Labour's policy, I sort of understand why they're waiting on the putting down the motion no confidence, because I don't suppose Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell have great relations with the DUP, but they're kind of probably trying to track what they are thinking. Because I think it wouldn't be that great if they put down the motion no confidence and they lost. That would give her a little bit of momentum, if only for a short period of time. So if that's the tactic, fine. If, on the other hand, it's actually just part of a ploy to keep this thing running and running and running and running, so that eventually Brexit happens, and then they get the general election that they've been after the whole time. So then if it's true that Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell deep in their hearts are actually Brexiteers, then
surely not. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm saying that if that
you
was
heard
the
it
case,
here first, and when I say first, I mean after everyone else.
But if that's the case, then they maybe get what two things that they want out. They don't have to own it, and it leads to a general election, and they may think they have a better chance of winning that. Now, as it happens, I think they have a much better chance of winning a general election if Brexit is still up in the air. But what they would then have to decide is a much clearer policy than they have now and that they had at the last election.
Do you think the European Court of Justice ruling that Article 50 can be unilaterally withdrawn, do you think that helps the people's vote position?
Yeah, I do. Look, I think we've had a lot of wind in our sails recently. I think the first big march where we got about 100,000, I think that was the point at which the media started to take us seriously. I think the second big march, 700,000 or so, that was the point at which I think the MPs started to think, well, something's going on here. I think they have, a lot of them have reported, and okay, some of these campaigns are organised, but a lot of them have reported quite a bit of pressure locally, letters, emails, visits to the surgery, all that stuff. So there's no doubt that on their radar, the people's vote is a lot kind of louder than it was. And I think I've been fascinated in these various statements that Theresa May's done. I mean, the teeth gritting seems to get more and more intense the more she gets asked about the people's vote. She obviously hates it. And the Andy Serkis, the Gollum spoof video that we were talking about earlier, he kind of captures that she really hates this idea. One thing we've not really managed to do, and we have to keep going on this because I think eventually we'll get there, is persuade people that far from it being anti-democratic to have another vote on Brexit, it's anti-democratic not to. Well, because it's so different to what was promised.
Well, part of the criticism is, of course, some people say that you lost the first one, so you're running a second one. And as we've discussed, Alistair, you do have a track record of running things again when you didn't get the result you liked the first time around. Is that argument...
For those joining late, that was a reference to a childish claim that you lost a quiz unfairly.
Are you ever going to let it go?
No. Perhaps slightly more seriously, is that argument better dealt with once a decision has been made on the deal, or is it acceptable to carry it on now when we're still in such flux?
We have been very, very clear about... Oh, God, I sounded like Theresa May there. We've been very clear.
Nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed. Look, the whole way through, that's another one she uses, and what's important to understand, we want another referendum, and we've been very, very clear about that. And I think we're entitled to prosecute that case in whatever way we see fit. Now, it's true that there are some people who they don't want to hear, they don't want to be told that lies were told, but I think it's quite important. I've been stunned at the way that our media, one or two brilliant journalists excepted from this, just they've seemed totally disinterested in the whole story of the crimes and the funding and all the rest of it. But more importantly, I think the next referendum, if we get it, it can't be a rerun of the past. It can't be like the same sort of campaign. It's got to be a debate about where we are now on Brexit and where we think we're going. And we have to do a much, much better job of reaching out to people who voted Leave and trying to persuade them that the problems and the challenges and the issues that made them vote Leave are not going to be helped by the Brexit that's being pursued, either Theresa May's or Jacob Rees-Mogg's and Boris Johnson's and Nigel Farage's, but actually by a different sort of politics, which I think something that's been interesting about this being involved in this campaign, it has felt really invigorating to be part of something just a bit different. You know, I'm as tribal as they come, right? Whether it's football or it's politics or anything else. But yesterday, for example, I was at the press conference where you had Ian Blackford, SNP, Liz Savile-Jones from Plaid, you had Vince Cable for the Lib Dems, you had Caroline Lucas for the Greens, Margaret Beckett and Anna Soubry, all on the same platform.
No Labour front benches?
unsurprisingly, no Labour or Tory front benches. But what was interesting about it was that these are people whose, you know, there's lots of things they would disagree about, but actually you felt a power in their argument because on this bigger question, that's why I don't think it can be resolved by a general election ultimately, because on this bigger question about Brexit, there was a sense there of people really stepping up because they sort of sensed the country's at a moment of peril.
But didn't all those people step up for the Remain campaign last time around?
Because I remember those events that I covered, about a million of them at the time, the kind of, you know, any combination of, again, yeah, so like Labour, Tory and whoever else, like parties on the same platform arguing, you know, saying we're coming together because of X. Like, that already happened. I think that's the thing I would say.
I don't think this campaign It's got to be different to the last one. I mean, of course, you've had shared platforms.
How is it going to be different? Well, is your primary approach one to get more Remainers out to vote, or is it to win over Leavers?
You've got to do both. I mean, look, first of all, there's some very big changes that I think are worth highlighting. They can't rerun one of the most compelling arguments that they had, which is the thing about more money for the health service. I think that is so discredited.
So they being the
Leave campaign. I don't think people, other than those who really, really want to believe it, are again going to buy the idea, which a lot of people did, that tens of millions of Turks were going to be coming into the country. And it's been interesting as well to watch. I was reading some of Ashcroft's polling last night about the way the immigration debate has kind of has calmed, it seems to me. It's sort of its saliency has fallen.
A lot of the polling shows that that immigration is not the important issue it was during the campaign. But what the polling also shows is that actually a lot of the reasons behind people voting Leave, it's not just that people saw 350 million on a bus and saw these people coming. A lot of these things don't go back even to 2008, they go back further than that.
I agree.
In fact, some suggest that they go back to the mid-1990s with New Labour making a conscious effort to engage with Middle England and leaving behind the communities in other parts of Britain that then chose to vote.
I can tell you for a fact, if that is what people think we did, it was certainly not deliberate. And I think actually that one of the problems that I think the Labour Party has given for itself, and I argued about this with Ed Miliband particularly, but I think it started a little bit with Gordon, is I don't think we did a nearly good enough job on defending our own record on what we actually did do for working class communities, which was a lot. Now, have a lot of those communities been left behind by globalisation, which we were kind of celebrating to some extent and not maybe being sufficiently aware of the potential downsides to it? Yes, I totally accept that. But my point about the way that the kind of argument landscape has changed since the referendum. But another point, just on the, you know about data and numbers, on the demographics, we're 902 days since the referendum. 1.5 million people have died since then.
17th of January is the flipping point.
Right. Well,
and so now, that's where simply in terms of what we call in the business churn means that the result will have changed. But that goes back.
Yeah, don't
that
forget,
goes
people, back to... people are going to move both ways. By the way, I'm not one of those people. I think you've got some Remainers. I mean, I talk to them. I'm on some of these WhatsApp groups that kind of drive me crazy because you've got all these people chipping in with their views. And they
I'm like
seem
that.
To think,
that's just my family group discussing
and your
Christmas,
viewers, your viewers group. But they seem to think that if we get the referendum, we're home and dry. I don't believe that. I think there's going to be an absolute, you know, it's going to be a really, really hard fight on both ends. I absolutely am confident it can be won, but it won't be won if people either think we fight the same sort of campaign or that we go around thinking that there are arguments that we have to engage in that last time we were very reluctant to do so.
Do you not feel like the same mistakes are still being made right now? Because I feel like, you know, they're still from like Remain campaign, kind of, I guess, continuity Remain campaign, basically saying, well, you know, the experts say this, or like, you know, X amount of economists agree that X. And like, these are, you know, this is what the Remain campaign did at the time that did not work. And that is still very much what's happening. That's still how Leavers' claims are being kind of like countered. So,
which goes back to my question about actually, it seems to me that the primary focus is to get more Remainers to turn out. We know that young people didn't turn out in the same numbers last time. If young people had turned out in the same proportion that older people had, Remain would have won.
Yeah.
And so as a tactic, to go back to your tactic and strategy, as a tactic, that's a perfectly reasonable tactic to win.
Totally.
I'm wondering, what does the referendum campaign and indeed what does the Remain campaign have to offer Leavers this time around that they didn't do last time?
I think it has to be... I'll give you an example of something. So, for example, I was doing the Andrew Neil Thursday night programme. What's it called?
This week.
Or that week or whatever.
Never been invited on.
And Matt Ford's on there every other week, apparently.
Yeah.
He must be funnier than you. And Caroline Flint was on. And
I'm definitely funnier than Caroline Flint.
Caroline Flint, who I remember as a very Blairite, supportive, felt that the politics are the same. And she's obviously in a very, very different position to me now. And she was sort of saying that, well, you know, all these people are out there talking about, you know, what we need to do now. They weren't very visible in Doncaster and Don Valley when I was during the referendum campaign. And I think there was a real feeling that the campaign led by Cameron Osborne, it was Project Fear, that, you know, that was how it became, that they allowed themselves to be labelled as that because they were just banging this economic drum. And Cameron going out and saying, if you vote Leave, you're going to destroy this great economy we're building. And millions of people out there saying, where is this great economy you're telling me about? That is not my life. So I think there's got to be a much deeper understanding of the issue, all of the issues, including immigration, including globalisation, including inequality, including the pressure on public services. There's got to be a much greater understanding of these being real legitimate fears and realities in people's lives, which, and then, second part of our argument, which are not going to be addressed by Brexit, and they're not going to be addressed by us pretending there was some great status quo ante. So we, in a sense, and I actually don't like even saying remain because it sounds so sort of static, but the if you like, the anti-Brexit side of the argument cannot just be a sort of status quo. It's got to be about change.
There's been a lot of discussion about the fact that it has to, next time around, more non-political figures need to be involved. Now, obviously, Gary Lineker is someone that's come up time and again. Will there be people outside those who went to your old school who will be involved? Will you be looking? Obviously, Emil Heskey would be the
Emil,
first choice.
When is he? Is he still in Australia? I don't know where he is. I mean, you've got...
Is he not on a WhatsApp group, an old boys not, WhatsApp group not, with you and Gary?
He's not one of the ones constantly chirping in with what you need to do is. I think you've got to be very careful about this. I know there's a kind of real anti-political mood. I accept that. That being said, when it comes to what will be a very, very difficult and sometimes quite brutal campaign, you can say what you like about politicians, but there are certain political skills that you need to be in front of these red, blue, yellow thingy-bobs and survive.
That's microphones for microphones, listeners at home, not chefs that we come in to provide us with food.
And survive the rough and tumble of a campaign. So I think you've got to get the balance right. You have to have politicians and on both sides. And who do the public identify with in these debates? They may say they hate politicians, but they want to hear from them. You know, this morning...
And they may say they like celebrities. Or indeed, they say they don't like celebrities. Yeah. But
Gary Lineker is a friend of mine, and he gets loads of stuff on social media. Stick to football, what do you know about politics? Well, but actually, Gary actually is a very clever guy and he's very good at saying what he thinks. And then you see other people, like if you look at the People's Vote rally that we had on Sunday, I mean, Michael Heseltine, Rosina coming out from the Labour front bench for People's Vote, you had about half a dozen MPs there. But then we had Brian Cox, we had Charles
Which
Dance.
Brian Cox? Or
Brian
both?
Cox, actor. We had Charles Dance, we had Eddie Marsden, we had Jason Isaacs. You know, these
Hello
are.
To Jason Isaacs.
So these are people who, they have a role. And part of that, to be honest, is just sort of showing a kind of sense of energy and a breadth of the campaign. But ultimately, campaigns have to have political voices. And I think it's become too sort of trendy to sort of say, oh, well, nobody listens to politicians anymore. They do and they don't. It's up to the politicians to be good at what they do.
I think the issue, as you were saying, you know, I think people who are not politicians are perhaps not always as good at talking to the media. And Lord Rose from the Remain campaign, in
Lord
one of the
Rose.
Very early interviews.
Whatever happened to him? I guess that's show business for
him. I still adore the fact that he just trying to talk about the campaign he was in charge of. He called it Stay in Britain. No, that's not right. Better in Britain. No, hang on. Better in Britain. Better stay in Britain.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that because, you know, if you go back, I do, you know, when I'm actually not making next to no money at all at the moment because I'm just doing this. But when I'm on the speaking circuit...
But we have provided
I know
you
give me a banana. That was nice of you. I've eaten. But normally when I'm out sort of just on the corporate, the very lucrative, what Al Gore calls white-collar crime, lucrative corporate speaking circuit...
I know it well.
And the number of... Matt Ford gets higher rates than you. And the number of business people I meet who say, why can't you just get really good, clever businessmen who know how to run business and get them in to run government? And I
Donald Trump, for instance.
Well, no, but we had quite a lot of business people, and the Tories have had quite a lot of business people. And if I look back, most of them found it very, very difficult. You look at people like Archie Norman, David Simon, who came from BP, he just found the scrutiny very, very difficult. I think if I look back, I think David Sainsbury was an exceptional science minister. He was without doubt. Paul Drayson at Defence, I think, was a businessman who came and was very, very good. But most of them find it very, very difficult. And it is actually this stuff that I think they find the hardest.
And of course, part of a Remain campaign's core vote will come from young people. So who do you turn to engage with young people better than last
June
time?
June
Sarpong, obviously good if it were 1994.
I think it's got to be Matt Ford. Yeah. And you. I think if you and Matt Ford could just...
I don't think there's anything Matt Ford and I couldn't do.
No. Look, I think one of the best things about this campaign have been these youth groups that have started up. OFOC, Our Future, Our Choice, FFS, you know, you can take...
I smell a pattern in the
Yeah, but so, but they have been great. And
the criticism of those groups is that all they're doing is speaking to people who voted for Remain last time.
No, but listen, OFOC,
Our
Future, Our Choice, I first came across it because of a guy who is now working full-time on it, Will Dry, who voted Leave and was feeling wretched about it. And so I think we have been bringing in people from all sorts of walks of life. The other thing we're going to have to do, if we get a referendum much better next time, is getting much greater activity in the regions, much greater activity, much more of a feeling, actually, that this is not just a kind of London thing, because it's not. When I've been going around the country, or Andrew Adonis, who I know you've had on the programme, do you call it a programme or a podcast?
On the show.
Andrew Adonis, who apparently doubled your listening figures to 4, which was great.
Because his
family,
a
very, very close family, very close family. You know, he's been going around the country, as have I. Literally, you go into places like Macclesfield and hundreds of people are turning out. And it's this idea that it's kind of London. You've got a lot of people in London who are leavers. You've got loads of people in the northern England, north of England, who are Remainers and who have changed their minds. I mean, I go to Burnley a lot to see my football team. Burnley was 66% Leave. It's got a lot of these challenges that we were talking about earlier. When we had our first win since September against Brighton on Saturday, on the way from the car to the ground, I had 4 people stop me to talk about Brexit. One was saying, got to get on with it. The other 3 were saying, keep going, we can stop this nonsense. And one of them had voted Leave and the other one hadn't voted. And the final one, just because I know the other line I keep getting told the whole time, is keep that bloody Tony Blair off the airwaves. One of them said he'd watched Tony Blair on Piers Morgan and Susanna Reid's programme, and he said he agreed with every word he said, and that's what flipped him. You're bound to cut that out.
What?
Part of the media conspiracy against the Blair New Labour legacy. I know it happens all the time.
You're right. thinking about the longer-term future, it's inevitable that a good proportion, whatever happens, a good proportion of the population is going to feel disappointed by what has happened. How do we all go about bringing the country back together again? It sounds like almost like a Coke ad or something that would be discussed at Christmas. But hey, it is Christmas. So how do we bring the spirit of joy and happiness back to a divided country?
Leadership ultimately is the answer. And I think that's what people feel at the moment. There isn't much leadership around. But I think the other thing, I mean, I was in a TV studio yesterday with Nigel Farage again. He was doing his usual sort of, you know, hell fellow well met and a bit of bonhomie in the green room and all that. And then he said, oh, you know, if there's another referendum, we'll win it. But then you'll have another one. Then, because that's what you people are like. And that's what the metropolitan elite is like. And he's not a part of that, of course. And that's what Brussels is like. That's what Soros is like. That's what Goldman Sachs are like. And on he goes. And I said, well, look, I actually do think if you got all of the main participants, all of the party leaders, all of the leaders of the campaign at the start of the referendum, who actually said that here are the 2 choices. You've got, I hope, Remain and Reform. You've got over here what has to be a credible, deliverable plan for Brexit, which they stand by. And then all these people...
No preferendum and no deal.
I don't think so. No deal, and definitely I think the third way choice for me doesn't work. I could be wrong, and it's not up to me, it's up to Parliament and the Electoral Commission. But I think if you had that, and even if you did have these other options, everybody saying, right, this is what's agreed, this is the system, and whatever happens now, whether it's one vote in it, that is what we do, and we all get behind that. I think you could start to bring the country together and use the referendum itself as a bit of a healing process, even though it will be very difficult and very divisive.
And finally then, Alistair, you're famous for your bagpipe busking.
Famous globally.
If you were to ask the general public which musical instrument they would most like to play well, what do you think would come top?
Have you done this?
We have.
Oh, wow, that's a great question.
Thank you very much.
You've asked the general public.
We've asked the general public, which of the following musical instruments would you most like to be able to play well?
And what did you give them as a choice?
We gave them a whole long list of things.
Did it include bagpipes?
It did include bagpipes. How many people do you think said bagpipes?
Not many.
Really not many. Although, but more than said banjo, cello, accordion, xylophone, oboe and tuba.
Wow. I'm going...
I don't know, it's just very annoying, and I'm very annoying.
In your role as a gypsy palm reader?
I am going...
Yes.
I'm going piano or violin.
I'm saying guitar.
Well, interesting. There was a big gender divide on this. Piano does come top overall.
I win.
36% to 23% for guitar in second place. Huh. But among men, guitar just edges it.
Right.
Among women, piano dominates.
Against guitar?
Against guitar and indeed everything else. Violin comes fifth.
Wow.
So the top five is piano, guitar, and then there's a big jump down to saxophone, drums, and violin.
I like to know how to play the theremin.
Alistair Campbell, thank you so much. Next week is our Christmas special, so we'll be back for that. I'm afraid there was no time for our interview with Matt Ford. He's
busy. Preparing for my book sale.
Yes, just a quick look at our Christmas cards. And I want to finish. I mean, I know, Alistair, it's a really lazy characterization to say that Malcolm Tucker from The Thick of It was based on you.
Yeah.
But just for the record, have you ever said fuckety bye?
No. I've never said fuckety bye. Well, I probably have.
You have now.
Well, yeah, now.
I probably have. I did have a swear off with him once.
With Malcolm Tucker
with
or with Peter
Capaldi, yeah.
Who won?
I did.
All right. Did you win the first time or did you then have to run it again?
Well, it was interrupted halfway through because it was in the city at one of these trading floors where BCG or BGC, and they give on 9/11, they give all the profits to different charities, and the different charities have to go along and pitch, and they basically decide who does best. And I was there for either for mental health, I think I was there for Mind or Bloodwise, I can't remember. And Peter Capaldi was there for Bernardo's, and somebody had the idea of the swear off. And we had a minute each, I think it was, and we had to swear as much as we could in a minute, but it had to make sense. And I told a story which was about my uncle and a milking machine which broke. And it ended by him turning to me and saying, fuck it, the fucking fucker's fucking fucked and I'm fucking fucked off with it. Which was pretty fucking good, right? And at which point, Malcolm Tucker, a.k.a. Peter Capaldi, clearly knows he's going to lose. He's like going to be the YouGov of this battle.
You mean the true winner.
However, he never got to do it because this guy came charging in looking like thunder and grabbed the microphone from me before I could hand it to Peter and said that the whole tirade had been broadcast into the creche. So, it was like a scene from The Thick of It.
Brilliant.
So I won.
Brilliant. We will be keeping that in. All the remains is for us to say a big fuck-de-bye to Alistair Campbell. Thank you. We'll see you next week. And thank you to Smarkets too. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.